I now give the floor to CGE. Thank you.
Morning, members, CGE and the guests. I've received apology from Mr. Nkonzo's attending PC on health, Lam Robinson Kweke and Kaula, they are out of the country. Thank you. And it's for 11 here.
Thank you, Chair. I must convey my thanks to the Chairperson and the members to accommodate us today. I have an apology. Our ACEO is on her way. Apparently, she has been held up at the airport. So I would sincerely apologize. She will join us just now. I just want to begin very quickly to look at the traditional costs bill. And give you a briefing. I'm going to try to be as comprehensive as possible, but it might not be possible to cover everything, so you are most welcome to question me after the session. Okay. If I'm too low, please let me know that I can speak louder. First of all, I don't want to talk about our vision and mission. I think the committee knows that very well. I'll only give you the mandate that we have. I think it's important to know the CGE mandate when it comes to dealing with legislation, because obviously we don't want to have the problem of crossing the boundaries of the tris politica. That means the separation of powers. Basically, in terms of the CGE Act 39 of 1996, 11(1)(c) and (d) speaks to our role in legislation. What it says, firstly, is that the CGE can evaluate any act of Parliament. In other words, an existing law can be evaluated if we feel that it's necessary to do so. The CGE can also evaluate any system of personal and family law or custom. Now this seems to be loaded. Now, a system of personal law would be, for example, Muslim personal law. That's the kind of personal law that exists in South Africa, and it is applied. Family law would be the law of succession and so on. Okay, divorce also falls under family law. Custom is a behavior or a conduct. Sorry, I think I must extend the
word. Welcome.
Thank you for the support. It's welcome. When you look at the meaning of the word custom and practice, they seem to be very, very close together, and I think we need to quickly unpack this here. Now, custom is a behavior or a conduct which is regarded as normal by a society or a group of people or a community in a particular time, space. Right. Now, for example, if you take initiation, that's a custom. Right. And what's a practice? Now, practice is any act that gives effect to a custom. For example, if you take initiation as a custom, what practices are involved? For example, it's only boys that will be kept away from the community. They'll be taken out into the fields. They won't be allowed visitation rights and things like that. Those are practices. So when we use the words custom and practices in the context of legislation, this is the distinction we must understand. Also, the CGE can evaluate any other law that it deems necessary. Any other law would obviously be customary law. Okay. And these laws can be evaluated at the commencement of the CGE Act. That means we have jurisdiction to look at the legislation after 1996, or as from 1996. And our jurisdiction extends to laws that are likely to affect gender equality or the status of women. That's where we must place our focus on. In Section 11(1)(d) of the Act, says that we can recommend to Parliament to any other legislature the adoption of new legislation which will promote gender equality and the status of women. So we can make recommendations to Parliament, to provincial legislatures, and even to local councils, in other words, municipalities, to adopt legislation which would improve the status of women or to promote gender equality. So that's our legal mandate within which we must function. Now, when we look at the traditional courts bill, now it has a long history, but I'm not going to go into it. Previously, what happened was the Black Administration Act regulated traditional courts in the way the traditional leaders dispensed customary law. And Section 20 of the Black Administration Act allowed the minister, and that would be the Minister of Home Affairs, to confer powers on a chief or a headman. Remember that headwoman was not mentioned in the law. And jurisdiction was given by the minister to the chief or headman to try and punish any black, and they use the word black in the act, who has committed in the area under the control of the chief or headman concerned any offense at common law, and they use the word black law and custom, other than an offense referred to in the third schedule of the Black Administration Act. And the Black Administration Act removed jurisdiction over a large number of conduct, for example, rape, bestiality, theft, stock theft, and so on. So that was the function of the Black Administration Act. But now the Black Administration Act has been completely repealed. So there is a gap. So traditional courts are not regulated by any statute as such. So that's a gap that exists now. Now, when we look at the traditional courts bill, and three questions normally arise. And firstly, the first question is, can we do without the traditional courts act, or can we do without traditional courts? That's the question that's uppermost and always raised, because the feeling is that traditional courts function or operate to erode the rights of women. Then the question that will follow is, if we don't have traditional courts, what would happen? What would happen from the legislation that we have? Traditional leaders can raise a constitutional challenge, because the constitutional court, as well as the Constitution, makes traditional courts a firm institution in our law. And the court in Bay versus the Magistrates Court of Khayelitsha had this to state. Quite clearly, the Constitution itself envisages a place for customary law in our legal system. Certain provisions of the Constitution put it beyond doubt that our basic law specifically requires that customary law should be accommodated, and the word is accommodated, and not merely tolerated as part of South African law. So here the Constitutional Court has looked at the function of customary law, which is dispensed by traditional courts. And they said, look here, it is a part of our Constitution, and it has to be respected, it has a place. Now, why did the Constitutional Court say that? They looked at Section 211 of the Constitution, and this is what the Constitution says. In Section 211, subsection 1, the Constitution states, the institution, status, and role of traditional leadership, according to customary law, are recognized subject to the Constitution. Subsection 2, a traditional authority that observes a system of customary law may function subject to any applicable legislation and customs, which include amendments to and repeal of that legislation or those customs. So here what we hear from the Constitutional Court is that customary law in traditional courts cannot be evaded. They have a firm place in our Constitution and in the legislative landscape. but they must be subject to legislation. And I just mentioned now, the Black Administration Act has been repealed. So there is no legislation regulating traditional courts. And this is where the problem arises. And to answer the question that I raised, would it be good not to have any legislation regulating traditional courts? No, it would be dangerous. Because then the traditional leaders are left to their own devices, and they can function with impunity, and there will be no consequences for their conduct. Okay? So that is what we must appreciate when you look at the traditional courts bill. So, in effect, what you're saying is the Constitutional Court is warning us. It says, don't make the mistake of saying, look here, let's not have a piece of legislation regulating traditional courts. Right. So that will spell disaster for our women. Okay. Any questions at this stage? We can continue. Okay. I won't look at this because it just elaborates what the Constitutional Court said. It says that courts must also take note of customary law where it's necessary and if it gives effect to the Constitution. On slide 8, I look at specific clauses of the Traditional Courts Bill. And although the Traditional Courts Bill looks very, very small, remember it deals with legislation that exists for hundreds of years. It also tries to bring in the Constitution, and it tries to fill in the gaps of the Black Administration Act, which is now repealed. So it's trying to do a lot, and it's loaded. So I will try my best to explain to you. If you look at Clause 2, which states the object of the Traditional Courts Bill, and it states here that the object is to facilitate the full, voluntary, and meaningful participation of all members in a traditional community that is regulated by a traditional court. So what function of the Traditional Courts Bill is to ensure that people who want to be subject to the Traditional Courts Bill, they must be allowed voluntary participation. Right. And if they fall within that jurisdiction of that court. But we know, and authors have told us, that if you look at the customary law as it exists today, we have a problem and we must be mindful of this, is that as the customary laws evolve, because customary law is living law, it deals with the lives of people and it evolves as people's lives change and society changes all the time. And as the customary law evolved, what had happened was that the privileged elite were given the opportunity to negotiate the changes that took place. And the interests of maybe the elite males were given prominence, and the interests and cultural experiences of women and youth was not given center stage. So they remain outside the codified customary law that we know. That's one problem we must take cognizance of. So if we're looking at the object of the act, of the bill, it's not an act yet. It says that the traditional courts must recognize the consensual nature of customary law, although it's promoting and preserving traditions, but the CGE feels that we should not use the word preserving traditions. Traditions need to be evolving. It's to promote traditions and not to preserve, because values that oppress women should be allowed to evolve and change. And the consensual nature of customary law, in other words, where people feel that they don't want to be subject to a traditional court for various reasons, that's a constitutional right that must be respected. So that's put into the objects of the act. And also, the object of the traditional court is to promote harmony and coexistence and peace. So we support it and we find that that's important. Then we come to the guiding principles, which is quite important, because the guiding principles can be the roadmap of the bill once it's promulgated. In other words, you always look to the guiding principles to see, look here, if there's any conflict in sections, once it's promulgated, then you test it against the definitions that you have in the Act and also the guiding principles. And if you find that those sections are deviating, then means that they need to be struck off or they need to be amended to be in line. Okay? So some of the guiding principles, what it says here is in 3.1 that the judicial courts must be aligned to the Constitution. So immediately if any provision or any practice in the traditional court infringes the right of any person, for example a woman or a child, then it's inconsistent with the Constitution and that act must be amended or the conduct of the traditional court must be challenged. Okay. So you find that the guiding principles are very well done. For example, I'll quickly go through some of them. For example, if you look at, I'm looking at the traditional court's bill, okay. If you look at Clause 2, the application of the Act, that's on, they haven't numbered the pages here, but it's Clause 3, Subclause 2. The Act, in the bill. It's on page 5, I'm sorry, it's on page 5 of the bill. Are you all with me on page 5 of the bill? I'm with the bill. Yeah, okay. Thank you, Chair. For example, if you look at Clause 3, Subclause 2. In the application of this Act, the following should be recognized and taken into account. The constitutional imperative that traditional courts, tribunals, or forums, when interpreting the Bill of Rights, must promote the values that underlie an open and democratic society based on human dignity, equality, and freedom. And interpreting any legislation when developing the common law or customary law must promote the spirit, purport, and object of the Bill of Rights. And they go on in subclause 2 to speak of the systemic unfair discrimination and inequalities or attitudes which are contrary to constitutional values or which have the propensity of precluding meaningful and voluntary participation in traditional court proceedings by any person or group. But, for example, if the traditional court wants to exclude somebody who is from the LGBTI community, they can't do it. If that person wants to be subject to that traditional court, he has every right to do so. And let's assume if the traditional court says, no, I'm not going to allow you the opportunity to air your complaint here, then what happens? You find that the traditional court will allow for the review process. This bill, when enacted, will allow that person now to take that traditional court's decision on review to the High Court. And remember that our High Courts are very astute and they have powerful jurisdiction. Then they will definitely set that decision aside, because what this bill is saying is that nobody can be excluded, because you can't discriminate against anybody on this ground, because it's spelling it out clearly. And in our law, we have what we call strict liability. Now, strict liability simply means, if it's in the Act, it's clear for everyone to read. So if you don't want to follow this out, and if you have the obligation to follow this, you are liable to go on review and sanctions imposed against you. And the sanction will be that the decision to exclude that LGBTI person or that woman, right, to be reheard, or the decision to be set aside. For example, if that traditional court did one of two things, said, I don't want to hear you, the High Court will say, you have to hear that person. Or it will say, look here, if that traditional court went on and heard that matter and ruled against the LGBTI just to punish him for nothing, the High Court will say, no, your decision is wrong. He is found not guilty. So those are the powers of the High Court, so they can intervene and review. So that's a protective mechanism in this bill. So you find that there are various protective mechanisms there which brings it and aligns it to the Constitution. So the guiding principles align TCB to the Bill of Rights, and as I said, they do it very, very well. What I've said here is that it prohibits certain conduct, and I've explained it to you. Okay, so no one can be discriminated against, and especially women. Now, you'll find that in traditional courts, what happens, and we found this during our hearings, the traditional courts will be placed or located near ancestral ground. And you'll find that they do this purposefully, because women are not allowed near those ancestral grounds. So, when that traditional session, that traditional court session is held, that woman won't be able to come because she knows it's a practice that she mustn't be in that area. So the traditional court will hold a session in the absence of that woman, and she might be the aggrieved party. So by conduct, they exclude the woman, and then that traditional leader will go to the High Court and say, look here, we had the session. She was told to come to the court, but she didn't present herself. But by default, she's not allowed in that area. People will shout at her and punish her if she's found in that area. So what protection is she having in terms of the traditional court bill? The traditional court bill says, if a decision is given in a person's absence, that decision can be reviewed and set aside. So once again, if they try this trick on the women, it will be set aside. All she needs to do is take it on review.
But to a court?
To a high court.
I mean, the problem already exists that, you know, to be able to access justice is very difficult. So, you know, this is going to be a very laborious process because you're now expecting a woman. I mean, technically the bill should just say that if a hearing was, I know you're not drafting the bill, I'm just sharing the bill, but I think it should say simply that, you know, if a hearing took place and found against you in your absence, that it should be null and void. You know, this thing of now expecting a woman, for example, in a rural area to go and approach the Durban High Court, for example, to set aside that ruling, I mean, it's not workable in my mind, because, I mean, already access to justice, where will she find the money, for example? To get to Durban, to get help in terms of seeking justice, or, you know, so it makes no sense. So, yes, you are talking about a remedial action that will assist a woman in the case that something is found against her, but I just don't see how it will work.
It's a good question.
I mean, it's a good point. Can I just explain? Can you just check? You want to say something? Sorry?
Yeah.
Let's put it bluntly. Traditional, the chiefs were the big dog. A woman is not allowed to attend the hearing. If she is called, she will be seated at the extreme gates of Parliament and not the one in front, because they choose you to represent me, and you know nothing about me, neither do you care about what the sentence might be, and they will be robbing me of my cattle and goats. Chief asked for a cow and two goats. The next time he'll actually escalate. All those decisions are taken without my understanding. In most cases, the worst of women are the widows. And those people who have amafam, abonemakaya, will understand what I'm making reference to. As a woman in the rural areas, I'm not existing at all. A man will be chosen from some corner to represent me. That is why we are saying they must scrap those laws. Scrap them. And if need be, we are prepared to take the platform and fight for the rights of our people. They mustn't put the foot. It's wrong. The very fact that when a chief dies and he's already nominated, it's in black and white that the person who will take over will be Uthokozile. They will fight that because of sex. It's a woman. Woman is a minor. There's nothing we can take from her. And those are the things we're fighting for. We're still because we refuse to be the wife of a dowdy, dirty man who hasn't had a wife, who hasn't worked, and then he decides my brother is dead. I'm taking over. That's it.
Thank you, Chair. I think you've given us a very good introduction to the bill as it stands, and I think that many of us know, because it's come back and forth 8 times, I think that we are familiar with what it's trying to do. I think that the committee's concern is, number one, voluntary and informed consent. How does the CGE, which submissions have you made that cover voluntary and informed consent? The other one is that no provision in traditional law may contravene or be different to or undermine the Constitution. What submissions have you made in terms of that? Thirdly, the Constitution says no one may be discriminated against on the basis of race, gender, age, sexual orientation, etc. So when a woman, A, has to be represented by a man, and B, may not even be a participant or a direct hearer of the case, how have you proposed amendments to those 5 critical things? Voluntary, informed consent, any sanctions or processes not to be contrary to the Constitution, discrimination in terms of gender, you know, and participation, and what was my 5th point? Oh, and the representation. I think that falls under the Constitution, but we know women may not serve on traditional councils or on courts. And exactly what you say, culture, tradition, religion must evolve. We are not living in the dark ages anymore where women cannot vote. A black person cannot vote. I mean, you know, they must evolve, and they must not be allowed to use the excuse of tradition and culture to oppress women. So if you could, I think we know what the bill is trying to do. How do you as the CGE address those concerns? Diabolel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, sure. Thank you. Before I just begin, the concerns that you raised in your... Sorry.
I haven't read the whole traditional bill. What I wanted to check is while you are dealing with this traditional bill, are you also taking cognizance of women who are born of chiefs and who understand to be firstborn, and they are sidelined when their father dies, and the uncles around the family will be the ones who choose who has to be the leader without involving the female, instead of she should be the rightful person. And if somebody has to be elected to take over from her father, she should be the one who should be consulted, and then amongst the family members, she together with other people can decide who now has to take over, rather than for her to be shifted aside simply because she's a woman. I think the bill also should look into that. I will tell you of a case in the Eastern Cape whereby the father who was the chief died, I'm sure 10 or 12 years ago. There's still a dispute today, and she is born of the first wife, and then there are other children from the second and third wife. And what they do, without her being consulted, being the firstborn of the senior house, they go and take a boy from the third house and bring her to her home and lock her out, and that if she wants to go home, she must ask permission from the younger brother, from the third wife. I mean, those are the things we are talking about, that how women, this is your mother's home, simply because you happen to be a woman, you are sidelined by the family members who are men, who will decide on your behalf that so-and-so must come and be in your home without your permission. Is that right? These are the discriminations that we are talking about. I hope the bill should also look into that, because people lose their homes because they are women. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think this bill is not supposed to be dealt with by only the members of Parliament, because I think there must be a thorough consultation, especially on the issue in rural areas, where all these things are happening under traditional leadership. Because mostly women in rural areas are married mostly on customary laws. We often see them almost every week going to Home Affairs and married today under customary law, not under civil law. Because if you are married in your under customary law, you are agreeing to your husband to take so many wives, you know. And if the women in the rural areas, because most of them are not educated about this, about their rights, there is where the men will take control to over this woman. Because if the woman doesn't agree that she don't want anybody rather than her in this home, or for her husband to marry another woman, then the man will go to his family and say, my wife doesn't allow me to take another wife. And all the family will come, and you are alone you are not even able to be represented by you, even by your brother. All of them will be saying to you, you are forced to agree that your husband must take 2 or 3, 5 wives. You know, that means if the women in rural areas should also be educated that there are two kinds of marriage, the civil marriage and the customary law marriage, so that they can be able to do so. Because the other thing that we have seen is people in rural areas, that even women are old as 85 years, not even registered their customary marriage. As soon as the husband died, what is happening? Then somebody will take up, take over to say, your husband has died and you don't have any heir or a son to look after all these things. Then you are allowed to go. You're not even allowed, you are chased to go away because your husband is dead. So now what are you going to do as a woman? Because if the women in rural areas can be told, no, this is a traditional bill that will say women in rural areas must choose between the civil or the customary law, so that they can be able to say, no, 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 I don't want any wife rather than me in this home, in this homestead. That is where the problem is. That is why people, women, men are taking over everything about on the issues of women, because they don't even respect them. Even the woman, if she wants to have a land to build her home for her children, she's not allowed, because she must have somebody who's represented her. If she don't have a son, then who's representing this woman? No one. You must go up and down now looking for somebody to represent you. And you are not even allowed to sit next to this man because you are a woman. These people will say, no, 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 we can't sit with the women here. Women must sit there, and the men are sitting on chairs, whereas the women are sitting on the grass, on the floor, just because they are women. So that is why I'm saying that this traditional court bill should be consulting all the women in rural, especially in rural areas, rather than us to come and discuss about these things here in Parliament only, because most of us, even though we come from rural areas, but we have seen the things that are happening in rural areas. That is where the discrimination of women is happening in very bad, in extremely, because people are uneducated, they don't know exactly how they are. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I just also wanted to add that the hearings on this bill has started in Parliament, and unfortunately our male colleagues mostly have belittled some of the people who came to make input on behalf of women and children. And I think our committee must firstly, before we go back to you answering some of our questions, but I think we should take note of that, and also maybe as a committee raise our concern with how people who came to make input to raise issues in terms of women and children have been belittled. And in fact, it shows the attitude. But also I want to caution that the issue of this bill, in fact, is progressive, because the fact of the matter is it's now bringing legislation where there's a loophole. Currently, these practices exist because there's no recourse in law or no protection for women. So I wanted to say we shouldn't rubbish the bill, because in fact, It is a step forward. But what we should, and also I think in terms of the debate around these issues, not all traditional practices are bad, because I've seen with my own eyes when I've attended a traditional court where there was something with regards to theft and intimidation of that. In some instances, traditional practices in that sense, where a community stands up to fight, criminals or criminal elements, their traditional practices in these courts are effective. So I just wanted to say that the focus should be on us making sure that this bill is a tool through which women are empowered and their constitutional rights are respected. But it shouldn't be a platform through which we just rubbish traditional practices in general, because they do help where in some instances. But I thought the issue of how Parliament is treating, especially our male colleagues, in terms of representation or presentation that are being made in front of them, which started last week, should be a great concern to us, because I don't think when people come and raise issues in terms of this bill and they make serious inputs, it was, for example, the Children's Institute, people who came on behalf of women, and they were ridiculed and belittled by male MPs, and we should say something about that.
My concern is, even in this era, we are still trodden on by a male counterpart.
In Parliament.
Yes. Why were we left out? And that group of traditional leaders were all male. There was no woman. And then this is the ninth time this bill is brought up. Eight times we've pushed it out. And we actually invaded the meeting as women from the NCOP. I mobilized well. Some were coming from Polokwane. All the provinces, we had them there. Wives of the chiefs were against the whole thing. And that is why I can't understand why it was brought up again. It wasn't us who are wearing fancy dresses and having wigs, and the rural women were there. And they were speaking, you know, about the atrocities they go through. Are we for the people? Do we understand the Constitution, or we still say women are underdogs? That's my argument. Even if I can be taken to court, I won't change. Yes, ma'am.
No, thanks, Chairperson. But I would like to say we are very grateful that the CGE is one who has taken us this initiative, because we know that all of you, we are working in rural areas, a medical clinic where you can be able to educate those poorly women about this issue. But no, I fully agree that when I am reading this period, it's good for other things. But the only thing that we are not happy about is the issue of consultation with these women. But we take it to you as CGE, because you are always there on with the communities, you are working with them, then you must have all those consultation by bringing all these issues with a simple language, so that women out there can understand exactly what this bill is all about. Thank you.
Any response?
Yes,
you understand? Yeah.
How it evolved was through consultation with the male elite. It was men only who were actually, you know, constructing this kind of piece of legislation. So even from the beginning, things went wrong. So from the word go.
So, and again, I really appreciate the members saying that you are not rubbishing it. All you are saying is that we should now look at a process where cultural, religious, as well as traditional practices need to evolve. And the bill itself need to go with the times, because we are no longer in that era where things were actually, you know, determined by males to actually talk on behalf of women, children, people, you know, persons with disability, as well as LGBTI. So it's no longer that period. So that is why I think we are actually revisiting the bill itself to look at the gaps, and make sure that we fill those gaps. I'm quite happy that CGE is on the ground. Chair, I'm reminded of some consultations that CGE was involved in 2017. I think we were in four provinces, if I'm not mistaken. Four provinces, very rural, and we actually consulted almost everyone. Women, men, chiefs, wives of the chiefs, people with disability, young people, you know, all the groups, vulnerable groups, if I can put it that way. And again, those consultations, Chair, actually were looking at the relevance of this piece of, you know, the legislation. Yes, the relevance, but also whether it's really still appropriate for us to move forward with it. So my honorable member, consultations were done, and we're quite happy to really even really present the outcomes of those consultations, because we did, yes.
But the very top people never did that.
Yes, we did.
Yes,
we did.
Family will say, even our forefathers, in the time of our forefathers, we didn't have a disabled child in this family. So that means that women must do something about this child. You know? Others, they will say, even if you have twins, the other one must be killed just because you are letting the case come to this family, because they don't have even having. And anyone of our forefathers here has got the twins.
So,
and you know how they killed that, they even stole those child, those twins, without your concern as a woman. You don't have a weight sometimes. That's the problem. But I think if this bill should be simplified in an easy language so that people can understand. This is a good bill for you, but these are the things that you must take forward so that this bill can be able to assist. And also look at the issue of models, you know, because we are living in a model era now, where our children are as families. We want our children, we are aiming our children to wear a trousers, you know, jeans, whatever. But when you go to the men's they will tell you that no, we don't want any one of our children here to wear trousers, you know. They are not allowed. All of you, all the girl child is some of the areas in world area, they are enforcing every child, a girl child, to go for virginity testing. It's either you like it or not as a parent, but your child can go there. And when the, your child has got something that has happened to her, then your family or the woman must pay something. Because the father is in Johannesburg, and the father will say, what are you doing as a woman? You know, our child has been damaged now. So everything that is happening will be upon that woman to say, you must explain why this child has been not a virgin now. That's the problem. But anyway, we are happy that she is taking this call.
Thanks. Can I just respond to some of the concerns raised by the committee members? Yeah. In 2012, when I was in the public consultation in Rustenburg, in the Northwest Province, you'd find that the meeting was attended by a lot of head women. And initially they were scared to talk because the males were there. And then after we told them, okay, this is a CGE gathering, so you tell us what you have to tell. Don't be afraid. And Advocate Kutswana was actually chairing that, and she was a female. So the women stood up and they told us, look here, we would like to have the traditional court spell because we want it to protect us. We don't want these males to violate us, to be unaccountable. So they are in agreement with what the committee members are raising now. Let the bill give those women the protection. Yeah, because they remained head women, and they were not promoted to chiefs. And then the previous bill was saying, look here, the senior traditional leader will become a presiding officer. So you can see what they were doing in the previous bill. The big chiefs were going to take advantage of the women. But now, you'll find that that has changed in the current bill. What it's saying here, and you look at it, members of a traditional court must consist of women and men, pursuant to the goal of promoting the right to equality. So here, there must be equal representation in those traditional courts. You can see it changed. Then just to answer a few other questions here. Yeah, I think that's, because you know why? What would happen here is that there's lots of checks and balances in the bill. For example, the Commission for Gender Equality must monitor these courts. Yes. And we must do it annually. So by putting that in the bill, the CG can walk into those courts, even if it's a female legal officer. She can't be stopped because the Act is saying, look, she has a right to be there. And she can question people and she can watch proceedings. Yes. The Act says you're allowed, nothing can stop you from doing it. Once it's promulgated, then you can report on it. It's there, yes. And I'll read it for you. It's in Clause 5, that's page 7. The Commission for Gender Equality, it's Clause 5, Sub-Clause 3B. Can you all find it on page 7? The Commission for Gender Equality, referred to in Chapter 9 of the Constitution, must in its report to Parliament each year report on the participation of women and the promotion of gender equality in traditional courts, and may to this end make recommendation on legislative and other measures. So in other words, it gives the CG quite a broad mandate to walk in there, observe, and report to you, report to the minister, and anybody else that the commission deems necessary in order to address any problems that they see in those traditional courts. So you have quite a nice check and balance. So we are satisfied with that. But the only problem is that costing. I mean, this bill has to be costed because it's going to be quite an expensive bill as well. It's going to have cost implications. Because they talk about the registrar being employed. And if those women are dissatisfied, if they feel that they've been disadvantaged, now the clerk of the court is supposed to help them with the review process. Because we say over here, if you look at the slide, although the bill has very, very wonderful provisions, we say the weakness is that rural women are most vulnerable to exclusion and being denied access to justice in rural areas. The bill has to provide meaningful steps to be more effective, such as, number one, the department must educate both traditional leaders and women on the rights contained in the TCB. In other words, once it's promulgated, go and educate them before you put it into effect. They must know the rights, because the moment they step into those courts, or those courts become effective, the women must know they have a right to be represented there. They must know they must have a right to be conveners. We don't call them judges or magistrates, but they are conveners. Women must also be conveners. See, so if they know about the rights, then they can challenge it. And if they're not happy with it, then the clerk, the registrar, and the clerk of the court must help them. They don't have to go and look for resources. The process starts in that court. So if we're monitoring, if the city is monitoring, and we find that the women are complaining, look here, when we are aggrieved and we are excluded, when we go to the clerk, he's not helping us, then we tell the minister, look here, you have to have in your regulations punitive measures, and we stay here. We state here in subclause 2. There must be penalties associated with any contravention arises that infringes the rights of women and children under the TCP and its regulations. They don't have this in the regulations where they can punish a convener. So we think, put it there. Don't say, look here, that it only goes in review and the High Court must say, look here, change. We say, no, remove that convener or make him pay compensation so he will learn his lesson. So that's the gap in the bill. Sanctions against violation of the rights, not just a simple review, a review with sanctions. Then these guys will learn the lesson. So that's what we say.
Yes.
No, I'm just thinking about the practicalities. Again, we are making a bill, which of course has got good intentions, but unless it's got massive resources to man every traditional court. You understand? Look, I understand we are working on a good principle. I'm just thinking again, in terms of resources, we'll have to have massive resources to make sure this bill is implemented properly, and that it actually protects all women in all rural areas and all of the traditional courts. So good principle.
But I think that point that you made in terms of the possibility, it's going to be mad. You see, now it's better in some of traditional courts. They are applying what is expected. For instance, in most traditional courts, there's a traditional clerk which comes from the department, employed by the department, to take meetings, to summon, to do everything. It is happening. So meaning, the more we are trying, government is definitely doing its best to come and make sure that all traditional councils have these clerks. I'm trying to help, so that it's already happening in most traditional. Yes, it is already happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. As the Honourable Member has indicated, they have started employing clerks of court who have some legal qualification, and they found that was a gap, because those traditional courts are a court of record. In other words, the summons that's issued must be documented. It must be recorded. The judgments made must be recorded. Any reviews must be recorded. So the processes have to be recorded, and now it's to be regulated. So the regulation will spell out all that has to be done. So there's uniformity in all the traditional courts. So if you take one, if you take a sample of maybe 10 across the country, and you find that 8 are conforming, then you know that they are doing what they're supposed to do. But if you find that 8 are not conforming, then you know you have to do something. And as the Honourable Liesl Westerhazen has pointed out, it's going to be a massive process. But you take a sample, and you've got to rely on complaints as well. And you look at trends, and you attack where the problems arise. And you also look for best practices as well, where it's working. to see why it's working and where it's not working, and then you reconcile the two. Then to address some of the concerns that were raised, let me quickly do it. We talk about representation. Now, because you're not going to have magistrates or legally qualified individuals presiding, they are not using the term judges or magistrates because they don't have legal qualifications and they don't want these rulings or directives, you know, to be misconstrued as court judgments. So they're using the term conveners, and they are not allowing legal practitioners to be representing people. So an aggrieved person must represent himself or herself or by a person he or she trusts. Now, this could be good, it also could be problematic. There are advantages and disadvantages. And we feel that it needs to be regulated because X could have a friend or a family member who's a lawyer, and then that person will get away or he will bring in conflict in that forum. Right. Or a convener could be a magistrate or a judge previously and now a traditional leader who's going to preside over that court. So they could use a standard which might be good. Or you might have a person, as the committee indicated, who's completely ignorant. And not apply any legal principles. For example, if you get a woman who has been assaulted by a husband, then he might be biased and says, no, the woman was wrong, she provoked her husband. And you don't want something like that. So that is why we're saying, look here, there are protective measures. If somebody is aggrieved, it can go on review. And if you're monitoring it, if you're monitoring these cases, then you pick these instances up and you deal with it. So we would like to see the monitoring aspect strengthened, yes. And we can report to this committee so you will know what's happening. Voluntary consent and informed consent as well. In terms of the procedure, the clerk of the court is supposed to explain when the summons is issued to any party before the court, you know, the nature of the issue, the procedures and the processes. The bill allows for that. And if the person feels, look here, that he or she doesn't want to allow this court to preside over the matter, then he or she tells the clerk of the court that. And as Honourable Member, is it Majeka? Yes, indicated. The clerk of the court is supposed to record that and listen to the complainant. Look, if you don't want this court to hear the matter, why? Is it being investigated by the SAPS? Then immediately the traditional court can't hear it. If it's been referred to the National Prosecuting Authority, once again you can't hear it. If it's a matter like theft over 5,000, there's no jurisdiction, the traditional court can't hear it. And the person says, look, I had an altercation with that convener. He hates me. So I'm not going to get a fair trial. So that can't be held, but it can't be heard. And she has referred to another forum. That has to be documented, as Honourable Majeka has indicated. So there is a protective measure there now.
I would like you to then, on behalf of the rural women, to ensure that you cover her back, because once she does that, automatically they chuck her out of that area. She loses everything because of this patriarchy. That is where most of the wrong are actually happening. We have to cover their back.
Chair, you're absolutely right. In Section 20 of the Black Administration Act, that was a gap. Yeah, if they found, look here, we want to banish you because we don't like your behavior, so the presiding officer could have a sanction, I'm banishing you from here. So as you said, they would lose their property and so on. So now here, what we need to have in the orders or the sanctions, they cannot issue corporal punishment, any punishment that's undignified. For example, we've had complaints where the person was a woman who was found guilty, but the traditional court said, look here, we want your son to put a sheep on his back and run right round. So such sanctions are not acceptable. So sanctions that impact on your dignity and which are unconstitutional, for example, banishment, must not be allowed. So we have indicated that. You are right. You're absolutely right. The other concerns, as explained, voluntary consent and an opting out is now in the bill. So if you don't want to be subject to it, you can opt out. And also, the clerk of the court is supposed to explain processes and procedures. So that helps them. There's been no monitoring, so we don't know to what extent, but it's supposed to be done. Now, once the monitoring is being conducted, you will know. You'll get an idea. Because now you have the legal jurisdiction to enter those courts. And the presiding officer can't tell you, look at CG, you're not allowed here. This is a closed session, or, yeah. So now we can monitor and see to what extent it's done. You're right. We will get an idea. The issue of male primogeniture, you know, where you have, women who are descendants of traditional leaders, they are excluded, and you get males from maybe the third family or the second family who are then placed in those positions of leadership. Now, that has been dealt with extensively by the CGE. In Kutama Sintamula, I think. I know we dealt with one case there. Also, there are similar cases. For example, the case of Bear versus the Magistrates Court of Kalicha. You know, it was a similar issue. Are some of you familiar with the facts of that case? Can I just quickly explain to you what happened there? In the Bear case, what happened was there was a couple. They were married in terms of customary law, and it happened right in our doorstep in Kalicha. Now, this husband and wife lived together. The wife had a good job, the husband as well. They built their own home. They bought the car, furniture, and she had children. And unfortunately, some along the line, the husband passed away. And then one fine day after the funeral and so on, the father-in-law rocks up there and comes and tells the wife of the deceased, look here, daughter-in-law, I'm sorry, you must vacate the house, and I'm taking the keys of the car. So she got a shock of her life and says, what do you mean? This is my car. I've paid for it. This is my house. I've been working, and my husband and I have paid for it. He says, no, but you married in terms of customary law. And we, the elders, now take over everything. And, she then took the matter to the Kalicha Magistrate's Court. And unfortunately, the magistrate agreed with the father-in-law. He says, no, look here. In terms of customary law, you follow the customs. And the customs allows the father-in-law to take charge of your estate and so on. She says, but my children are dependent on me. It's their house. What nonsense is this here? He says, no, unfortunately, you chose to marry in customary law. But customary, to be married in terms of the recognition of customary marriages act doesn't allow that. You married in community property. Yes. So I couldn't understand that. But then it went to the Constitutional Court, and the Constitutional Court was scathing. And we were involved in the case. I mean, the CGE acted as amicus. And the Constitutional Court ruled in favor of the spouse and said, no, look here, she is entitled to inherit from her husband. And that recognition of customary marriages regime protects her estate. And you can't come and just take it away. So the Constitutional Court has ruled, in favor of protecting the rights of spouses married in terms of customary law. And also, the latest case that was in 2014, I know I did the papers there, where Honorable Bengal raises the issue. It's in the rural area, the wife is married, and then suddenly when the husband dies, she finds that another wife emerges from out of the woods, and she wants to claim the estate. She says, but no, I didn't even know you. And my husband didn't ask me for permission to marry you. And the Act states very clearly in Section 7, if he wants to take a subsequent wife, he must get the permission of the existing wife. And the High Court did not rule to protect the first spouse. So we took it to the Constitutional Court, and the Constitutional Court said, no, no, look here, that marriage to the second wife is invalid. And the first wife inherits the entire estate because it's a good judgment. And also what the court said, and we liked it very much, it said, one of it is, you know, you have a responsibility. Go to the rural areas and educate those women. Tell them about the rights in terms of the customary marriage act, that the husband can't willy-nilly marry somebody else. He needs to get permission from the first spouse, first wife. So you can see that the law has developed, and the honourable member is correct. Education, these departments are not educating the people. You know, we have developed the law to protect the women, and they are protected. So thank you for that. And you see, the traditional courts will regulate the courts, but if you want issues like this to be dealt by the traditional courts, there might be a danger where these leaders will protect the status quo. You know, like the magistrate in Kalisha, most probably he was an ex-traditional leader because he ruled in against the poor woman. And we had to go to the Constitutional Court to protect her. And she didn't have the resources, so we helped her. So at least that Constitutional Court ruling will stand now. Other courts must follow it. Even the traditional courts have to follow it. So thank you for that. I mean, your concerns are absolutely valid. I mean, you're raising absolutely valid concerns here. And education is important. Yeah. Those rights have been established, but they need to be educated. So have I answered your question, Honorable Bengal? Do you want any further clarity on it? So I just want to come back to what Honourable I'm sorry.
Pandemerva.
I apologize, Lizzo. No, but I think you're beautiful.
But
I'm sorry.
No problem.
Can I call you Honourable Lizzo?
You can just call me
Liz. Liz, okay. No, her point is absolutely correct. We can't rubbish this bill because let's tailor it, because the Constitutional Court is saying, look here, I mean, if you have an act that's protecting women, then women can rely on it. And if they come to us for protection, we will protect them. You know, if you're just going to leave those traditional leaders to do what they want, you're going to really violate the rights of women. Then they're going to go and say, look here, there's nothing stopping us from doing what we are doing. Where's the law saying that I can't make this kind of ruling?
No.
That the woman got one slap and she provoked the husband. I can hear it because it's a customary marriage. I have jurisdiction over customary marriages. So how do you challenge that? But the Act will say, look here, that assault cannot be dealt with by a traditional court. So you can say, look here, traditional leader, you're not supposed to hear this matter. It must go to the match court. Okay, so those are the protective issues. So you're 100% correct. Please.
Thank you.
And other members. Do you want me to deal further with this bill? I think we have an understanding as to where we need to go with this bill. I mean, your guidance is perfect. Thank you very much for it. Do you want me to quickly look at other pieces of legislation we were looking at? Then I'll go quickly to the maternity and paternity benefits. I think that was a real important issue that we were dealing with. Now, very quickly, what happened was we had a complaint where professional women were complaining that they were excluded from UIF benefits. And the commissioners felt, okay, that the UIF Act needed to be revised to protect professional women, because although they held professions, when it came to their reproductive rights, financial constraints prevented them from exercising their reproductive rights. So we went to the South African Law Reform Commission, and we started looking at the issue, and we were quite amazed as to what happened when we started the consultations, because we felt, look here, is it only professional women that we need to look at? So when we started the consultations, and in Durban last year, we called informal traders, and there were some beautiful thoughts that they really raised with us. Now, the interesting thing was that the city of Durban called for the informal traders to come to a meeting at their chambers, and the CG also called for informal traders to come to our meeting. And there was a 100% turnout at our meeting and zero at the city of Durban. Yeah, I wonder why. So I don't want to make any assumptions. I leave it to the to our wonderful committee. They are capable of making good assumptions. But what transpired over there is they raised concerns like, look here, we don't have any benefits whatsoever. We can't even contribute to the UIF because we're not deemed to be workers. Number two, when we have children, what happens? Our boyfriends and husbands run away, and we can't go and stand in our stalls and perform our trade. We must come back to work immediately because we're paying rent to that city and they take away our stalls. Or if we put somebody to work, they steal from us. Also, we can't bring our babies there. Even if our babies are 6 months old and so on, it's unhygienic. There's also theft and robbery and so on. So they raised numerous issues that were so pertinent. Because we were looking at only professional women, then I said, no, let's look at informal traders as well, because they would fall under the same discrimination as professional women. So the CGE was right. And then also, some men also attended, and they said, look here, when we are in a gay relationship, we also adopt children. Now why are we are excluded? Also, some men were saying, look here, we also love our wives. We love our children. Why must women be given 6 months and we not even 6 weeks? So we said, okay, it's true. But obviously we're going to have problems because there's an economic aspect to it. Employers are going to say, okay, we can't cope with the financial drain that's going to be, you know, placed on us. We need to appreciate that. For example, if you have a small business run by, let's say, Liesl, and she's only generating maybe 10,000 a month, and if an employee is not there, she might not be able to pay that employee for 6 months. So aspects like that has to be taken cognizance of. So we called in the Human Sciences Research Council while we were in Durban, and we told them, look here, these are the issues, and they agreed with us. Look here, we can't ignore the plight of these women and these men. So let's do a scoping on the extent of the benefits. Let's see how insurance companies can come to the party. And we told them, look here, as far as we know, and the UIF is not telling everyone this year, they have a surplus of billions in the fund. So they can extend. Yes. Yes.
Of billions?
Of billions, yes. Yes.
People are suffering that much.
Yes.
They
don't have
to pay at the moment.
Correct.
They've got too much money.
Absolutely right. Yes. And why are they punishing our poor women and men out there? So they said, look here, let's scope those benefits and bring the UIF to account. So that's where we are at the moment. Right, so that was a CG-initiated project, and the Law Reform Commission has been 120% with us. And I've been appointed by the Minister to serve on the advisory committee, so we are at the forefront. Thank you very much, Chair. And then in terms of Kutwala, now what has happened there is, I think you know the history, we have a paper, and the issue that we had to skirt around. Now, very quickly, the Law Reform Commission paper has found four scenarios when it comes to a kutwala. Now, the first scenario is that where the girl now wants to marry and she's a participant of the process, you know, of the carrying rape or marriage. The second scenario that they identify is where the family wants a girl child to get married and they don't inform the girl child, so she's forced into it. The third scenario is where the family wants to force the negotiations and they do inform the girl child or the girl there. And the fourth scenario is where the two parties are finding it difficult to find spouses or they're finding difficulties to get married and they're using the process of Pukatwala to find spouses. So it's to address a social need. So that's the findings of the Law Reform Commission, but we are stating on record is that we want to deal with the unlawful form of Ukatwala, where children are being forced to marry, and also adults who are forced to marry, and they are raped in the process. So the unlawful aspects of Ukatwala. So the Law Reform Commission feels, look here, that some of the Constitution protects customary practices. And when you go into the deep rural areas, in 2010, even when Minister Radeba was out there and he told the NPA, look here, prosecute families that sell the children or force the children into marriages. And families resisted. They said, look here, this is the cultural practice. And we're not going to come forward or we're going to keep this undercover. So he was at odds. Even the CGE has been involved in saving children from forced marriages. And the Law Reform Commission has documentary evidence of where the CGE went into these rural areas and removed the children from the clutches of elderly men and also from these relationships and also impending marriages. Depends when we were alerted to it. So the best thing that they felt was, look here, the resistance is going to come from traditional leaders and so on. Because at this point in time, traditional leaders are helping. They are also coming to the party and saying, look here, we don't want children to be forced into marriages. So we want to keep them, you know, on our side. So we are saying, look here, let's address the issue of forced and child marriages. And it's interesting because that will become a specific crime. In other words, it's going to be criminalized. And anyone who assists in these marriages, even if they help in any way, if they groom, if they counsel, if they force, if it's a family member, if it's a friend, if they help in the abduction, even that conduct will be criminalized and will face severe penalties. So making that offense a consequence, the problem you want to address is the forced and the child marriage. A specific offense is a great way to deal with it. So there's no excuses. And everyone involved in it gets punished. Exactly, even if you know about it, and if you stay quiet. Absolutely right. And that's where the conspiring comes into effect. If you conspire, because if you knew about it and you just shut your mouth, you assisted. Because that's an omission. So in our law, an omission where you have a duty to act is punishable. Exactly. So... Sorry.
We're doing oversight. And we have the police. Okay. Where mother was saying, I was also a victim of Ukutwala. And we were saying, toughies, you didn't fight it. But now, we actually got 50 kids were abducted. You're a young man. An old man abducts a 13-year-old child and make a wife out of her. That's murder. It's murder. And I'm happy because what we were exercising here is how we could be able to stop it in Ethiopia. You understand? People were arrested on the street. No bail. And then I just ask you as a man, how can you actually abduct a 13-year or a 14-year enforcer to have sex with you? That's your grandchild. But men don't look at it that way. And the mothers sell their kids for a goat. I got a shock of my life. What is this world coming to? So we must, some of the traditional laws as candy, I would really like them to be scratched and people charged. Because the life of those children is ruined.
Che, you're absolutely right. And this is where the traditional courts bill comes into play. Because let's assume if that child was abducted by a traditional leader or even a clergyman in that community, and he goes to the traditional court and says, look here, this is Ukutwala, and the traditional court is now empowered to listen to this matter, you're going to have a problem. You understand? So that is why now we have to exclude such matters. And the traditional courts bill is supposed to assist here, not allow it, because that's punishable. That's abduction. That's kidnapping. It involves rape. And also you'll find that when you look at Ukutwala, research has shown that Ukutwala is not supposed to involve sexual intercourse. And if it does, for example, where the girl is taken, carried away and left to the care of the other ladies, if sexual intercourse takes place, then they must pay damages. Now that's trivializing rape. You cannot trivialize rape. Yes. So these are the problems that you have with these cultural practices.
And how are we then going to be fighting the spread of HIV?
Maybe if I can ask the CGA, how are you working with other organizations, NGOs, especially because now we have found that the South African Law Reform Commission was opposing the issue of sex work and the decriminalization of sex work, whatever thing. And how do you, when we meet with this South African Law Reform Commission, what did it feature in this traditional court bill? Because you know that these things are happening even in rural areas. But because the people, the traditional leaders in rural areas say, no, these things are not happening here. They are only happening in towns, you know, and big towns. But whereas you found that there are children, especially the girl child children, that are dropping out from school, that are being used by the blessers, you know, and all those children are being taken out from school by those people, and even the families, they agreed that, you know, we can't keep a child, a girl child in school, you know, for a long time, because we want the child to get a conversation about with this child, especially the Ebola thing, and she can't keep the child at school for a long time, because now she's able to read and write. Then what's the meaning of keeping your child at school? So how are you dealing with this issue? And other thing is, what I'm saying is there should be educating of the people that are there in rural areas. I remember one case that came to our constituency office to say there was a child, a girl child, a family from Pietermaritzburg. They come and stay in the Umsinga area. When the child, the girl child was pregnant, and the family talked with the boy, family, to say we wanted our baby because we impregnated our girl child, which was doing standard 8 at school, grade 6. So, and the family then after they have seen it, they are free to them that they are going to pay the damages. But eventually when they arrived at Umsinga and they found that they have seen the family taking the two cows, and they have sold those two cows to another area so that they get money instead of taking these cows and give to this family for paying those damages. Thereafter, the family of this girl found that no, even instead of these cows being brought to them, then they are taken to somebody else, to another area. Then they went to the traditional court. There at the traditional court, both of them were asked to come to the meeting, to the case, and then they were discussing the case. But eventually the women, these ladies, this girl's family, when they arrived there, then they found out that the traditional leader said, no, because those people who are saying that they come from town, they don't know anything about the cows or whatever. Then you can give them anything you want. And this man said, the uncle of the boy said, no, I've gone to the magistrate court, and the magistrate court said, to the magistrate, and the magistrate said, no, I must give them anything. Therefore, now I'm going to pay them 200 shrines for damage, which was supposed to be two cows and four goats and other stuff. But I've left these 200 shrines to the traditional leader to say, you must give this family, this is a damage, because they don't know anything about the cows. And the family, when they arrived there, the traditionally they said, no, this case has been closed, because you are from town, in Peter Marisbeck, you don't know anything about these cows, how are you going to keep them? This is the money that has been left by this family for damage, 200 tribes. And this woman take this issue to our parliamentary constituency office, and we said, no, it can't be like this, because all of us, we know what is happening. We are in rural area. We know that the damage is two cows, four goats, blankets, and a big dish. So now you can't just give that woman 200 rand. But the traditional leadership was so arrogant to say, no, I can't talk with you because you are the politician. So we take this matter back to the magistrate. And the magistrate said, no, because this family now have moved to Umsinga. Now they know they are right now. You know, after 2 years after this issue. Then that is when now, after the girl has been gave birth to the baby boy, which is now 18 years, they have been now paid damages. Just because of this case that has taken so long between the traditional leader and the magistrate. Because the family is now saying, no, we have paid the 200 rand, so what are you? What do you want from us? That is why I'm saying that the issue of education in these areas is very important.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for those valued questions, Honourable Member. I think, Chair, you're quite right in terms of saying how do we make sure that girls are protected from getting infected from sexually transmitted infections and HIV and AIDS, because this is also another area that is neglected. It's not known that, you know. And again, I think the concern is that older men don't even bother using condoms, for an example. So a girl gets abducted and raped, and the condom is not used at all. But I think your question, on the Honourable Member, that talks about how do we work with NGOs in addressing issue of sex work. I'm sure you are aware that CGE submitted, there was a submission that we made last year to the Multi-Party Women's Caucus. That paper was basically a paper on decriminalisation of sex work. And again, I think there were a lot of papers and consultations prior that
And we do know the recommendations that were made by the Law Reform Commission that was talking about partial criminalization, non-crime, and all of those things. And again, I think we moved forward with what we believed. And again, I think what was also progressive was to actually see the recommendations of the 54th conference. In Johannesburg in November, that was actually saying we need to move on with the decriminalization of sex work. And this paper is evolving currently. We're working with NGOs, both at national level as well as, you know, provincial and local level, because that is key. If I can just mention one of the NGOs that we have worked with, in terms of really targeting communities and educating both girls, boys, women, and men on this issue was Sonke Gender Justice. In fact, when we started engaging Sonke, for an example, we asked them, we commissioned them to do a study so that we understand the, you know, what we were dealing with. So we commissioned them to do a study, a research in February 2017. And to really look at, you know, issues that we need to address. And we also consulted with SWET, which is also another national organization, and we worked with SAPS. NGOs that are in the rural areas, for an example, there's a case of Ukutwala that we addressed, and we won that case in the Eastern Cape in December last year. And we were able to actually move the young girl from that house, La Ubetwele corner, and to take her away and back home. And there were issues really about the mother saying that, no, leave her alone, she's fine. And that girl was moved from the mother's house then to another house because the mother was saying, I don't see anything wrong. They have paid me those two goats, as I said, Singangani Agwetu, and she didn't see anything wrong. So we work with a... you know, locally based NGOs to say, you know, the you know, education needs to be strengthened in those areas. So there should be workshops that are held with young girls so that they know their rights. That if we are Ukutwala, if it's completely against your right, you have to say no, and you have to fight for your right, irrespective of what your mother, your father, or what has been paid for you already. But you know, you should know your rights. So those NGOs basically are there to educate young girls, young men as well, older men as well as older women. Because like Chairperson says that Abo Mama would say, no, but I'm also a victim of Ukutwala, so I don't see anything wrong with this. So we are also educating the parents to say, against the will of a child, it's a, you know, you are violating the rights of a girl child. So we are working with those NGOs at all levels. Thank you very much. Oh, yes, and SAPS. Thank you.
Just to add to that, what you find is that what adds to the problem is the understanding by social workers. You know, when the CGE went down into communities and we spoke to social workers and told them, okay, don't you come across instances of Ukutwala? They say, yes, we do, but we counsel it. And the CG was horrified. They said, no, but that's a criminal offense. Sorry? Yes. Social workers indicated that they were counseling victims of Ukutwala, and we were horrified because the CG is working with NGOs in those areas. It was in KZN. So you can see, I mean, officials such as social workers don't respond correctly. That's supposed to be reported to the police immediately, or the NPA. So, if this proposed bill is signed off by the minister, it's gone to the minister, because once you have this form, in other words, a draft proposed bill by the Law Reform Commission, means that it's been sent to the minister, and the minister must now take steps to enact it. And we think it's a beautiful piece of legislation because it gives the aggrieved party access to a protection order immediately, but it also criminalizes it. So there's no excuses by anybody, you know, not to take steps to protect the victim of any form of kutwala. And also, just to mention, there is a task team in KZN that deals with complaints. Yeah, yeah. And they're quite active. And the CGE's legal clinics has helped a lot because we've started networking with organizations. And to a large extent, you find that these organizations alert the CGE. And our legal officers have, you know, worked with these networks and went to those men who had the children there and removed them from the children. Removed the children from those men using the police. So it was quite interesting that the community members, the family members, were afraid to act, and they alerted the CGE, and it had to take the police and the CGE to intervene. Because people are so terrified. And the members are correct. It's the financial desperation, you know, that forces families to sell the children into these kinds of servitude, which is horrifying. And they lose schooling. They lose the future. I mean, they lose their dignity. They lose the opportunities. Those could be doctors. Those could be engineers. You know, and they lose these opportunities. So the social loss, you know, is enormous, and people don't understand that. Parents don't understand, let me help this child. One day maybe you'll become a professional and assist me and uplift us and himself. They don't have that forward thinking. So it's this hopelessness that we need to, you know, address as well. And as I said, it's sad that social workers don't give them hope, actually places them into worse, yeah. And then the last thing I want to deal with is 2 minutes, is the, sorry? Yeah. Sure. Is the land rights issue. If you look at the land audit, the CG has always been talking about women and how they dispossessed of land. And the latest land audit shows that if you look at nationally, farmland owned by blacks is 1.2%. For whites, it's in the region of about 23%.
Yeah.
Institutions own in the region of about 70% of farmland. So what it's saying is that our people are disenfranchised from owning land, and that needs to be addressed. And the worst off are our women. I mean, who rely on, you know, using land for agriculture to sustain the family and livelihood. So the issue that when you look at institutions, who are the institutions? Institutions are cooperatives, Z, other cooperatives, you know, that make huge profits, exploit our labor and things like that. And the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform has not been doing this yet. Because when you register property, they're supposed to know who are these institutions, who own this institution. Don't tell us it's owned by an institution, but land is owned by an institution. Who's behind that institution? You understand? So that's a huge gap in the way property is registered in our country. So the CG is looking at most probably drafting a land rights bill, which we're going to present to you, we hope, and we're going to ask you to assist us to table that and bring that into effect. So we're going to start to work on that. We're actually doing the research at this moment. Thank you very much for this engagement. I think it was useful for me, and thank you for your guidance. You're always wonderful.
Thank you.
It's a real pleasure to work with you like this.
I'm horrible. Shadow 2. You have got your shopping list thing. Page 15.
Let's look at G. Page 15. We'll cut you out. I expect the ladies to talk to this. What are the implications of what is in front of my eyes as a great-grandmother? Schedule 2, page 15, G. That are matters which traditional courts are, can you see?
Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, you can. No. Let's discuss it before I set your houses on fire.
Yeah, just to respond to it. What, what the Act has done is it has provided, inside the world, provided a broad framework, and then what it's done is it's educated lots of issues here. And the Minister's been to draft regulations as to how the conveners are going to deal with each issue. For example, if we're talking about the process, we're going to have regulations talking to the process in the court. If it's counseling, we're going to draft regulations as to what exact steps can be taken by the conveners to deal with counseling. What does counseling mean? What will they be able to do in such instances? What are they going to be doing? At that stage, when they're drafting the regulation, you will be able to comment on it and shape the regulation. Because that's going to actually talk to the exact activities that the judicial courts are going to be involved. So, we don't know what they could be thinking when they talked about counseling. They haven't even defined it in the Act. The regulations will most probably define it. And you're right. We've got to wait for that regulation and focus on it. And you're absolutely right. I agree with you.
So we don't know what they mean by counseling, what jurisdiction they're going to have, how they're going to deal with it. Exactly. Who's going to be the counselor? And you're right, a judicial leader doesn't have that expertise. Are they going to call in counselors? Or are they going to refer that person to a counselor? Because that is what we're going to say. Expert counseling. Refer for expert counseling and the report be tabled, you know, for the attention of the convener. Something like that. Che? Thank you for that. You're really alert. You're not horrible. You are really fair. You're fair to our women and our girls. You're a blessing. Yeah. Yes, you understand it. Yes. And this is what we need. I mean, the sharp eye and the sharp mind, because you think with the heart. And these are the issues that these girls and women are going to face.
Once we're there, CGE, how are you dealing with incest? Men, you can answer. You can answer.
Did ma'am answer?
You are the
Chairperson, before Kamraj answer, I'm looking at this list and I'm quite worried about the list, because I'm looking at the
the forced marriages bill that says Ukuthwala must be criminalized. My narrow understanding of what I just read in front of me, because I'm not reading from a law perspective. So if the traditional court bill allows for those leaders to advise on Ukuthwala, it will be in contrast to what the bill is saying. So I think what CG needs to do is to look at these two pieces of legislation together with the Customary Marriages Act, as well as the framework that governs traditional leaders. We need to take all four of those pieces of legislation. There might be more that we have to look at it, saying, if you look at this is in contrast with this, and therefore it can't be in this bill as one of the things that need to be advised upon by the traditional leaders in the traditional court. Because all of them around initiation is the same thing. We know our issues around initiation, especially in the Eastern Cape, as well as other provinces. We lose many, many young men yearly on initiation. There's been numerous support. We have done a little study in the Eastern Cape to look at what has happened. Other institutions have also looked at this. The CRL has looked at that. There's a report that says in 1 year they lost 52 young boys. So we have to look at all of these things and say, how does this piece of legislation impact on what we're bringing out now around forced marriages? Because they're not speaking to each other. And they're also not really speaking to the Children's Act and all of that. I think what we will do as the CGE, perhaps what we can do, come with a position paper for the committee, come back to the workers and say, here are the cons and the contrasts in these legislations, and they don't speak to each other. And if we put all of them out, we need to be mindful of the one when you're drafting the other, because they seem not to be drafted taking into consideration the others. And I'm me speaking from the perspective of CEDAW, which is our well of rights as women. This impacts badly on us as women. If this bill gets passed and it's raised again, because these issues will not be addressed, women will still find themselves in the same situation that what we are finding ourselves now.
And once you're dealing with all these things, do me a favor. Address the plight of our young boys who are sodomized just under our eyes. And that is why the number of stray kids is increasing. Because we don't even listen to our kids when they talk to us. And this fear of saying, oh no, you're too young to be discussing those things, is rubbish. Some of these kids are sodomized at home. That's why I brought up the point of infant, where the father lifts the wife in the bed and jumps into the child's bed. And she ends up being pregnant, and the wife can't say anything. Why? What are we doing about it? Women, let's stand together and fight for the plight of our children.
Thank you. But I'm also have concerns with regards to these matters that are written here, that they are being referred to traditional courts. The issue of number C, which is assault where a grievous bodily harm is not inflicted, as well as the F, crime injuria.
Yeah.
Because here, when we talk about the issue of violence and abuse of women and children, these things are not even be able to be taken to the traditional court, because it's a criminal offense. It must go straight to the police for the police to investigate and take the perpetrators to court for them to get what they are deserving. And also on the issue of theft, you know, we have seen that in rural areas mostly there is his cattle theft, you know, which is happening there. And when you say that the person has to claim, it must not involve more than 5,000 rand. What's happening if you're taking all the cattle in the cross? But you say no, just because it's not exceeding 5,000 rand, then you must go to the traditional court. Because that is theft. You don't even compromise that. You just go straight to the police if you know that the perpetrator has done it. But when you're saying that you have taken this as a schedule too, then what are you waiting for the people? Because even the people will take their law into their own hands just because of that. Thank you.
Oh,
I wanted to talk about. Because I've heard that there was a wage bill, even though we didn't know about it. And when we heard from other members who said that we were there by this time, this wage bill was also going to assist the economic empowerment of women. But when you're taking this now, this traditional court bill, and you compare it to wage bill, even though the things are not the same, but how is the wage bill going to make the women exactly be able to know their rights, instead of just saying that no, because the wage bill was by that time, now let's forget, let's move on with a traditional court bill, because we must know that not all the women are staying in rural areas. They are from urban areas. Thank you.
Thank you. I can't leave the chair's question out. Incest, you're right, it leads to HIV. It's a very hidden problem, you're right, because you find that families feel stigmatized. They don't want to talk about it. Incest creates psychological problems, severe psychological problems, maladjustment. It also leads to criminality, I mean, because of the psychological problems. It's so huge. But the problem is that it's hidden. And it's a specific offense. It's actually a sexual offense and attracts a serious penalty. So whenever the CGE comes across it, we are forced to monitor it. And if it's not reported, we make sure that it's reported to the NPA and the police investigate and prosecute. Because that's a criminal offense, they must be taken to court, and a severe sentence follows normally. So you're right. So we ensure prosecutions where incest takes place when it comes to our attention. But as you correctly point out, it's a hidden phenomenon. Families are afraid to bring it out into the open. That is a reality. Yeah, correct. Yeah. You're right. The issue of the wage bill and the traditional courts bill, the wage bill was a women's empowerment bill and a gender equality bill, so it spoke to two things. And the economic empowerment, you had some very good clauses there. For example, companies and state departments must develop programs to empower women. They also had the 50-50 provisions in the wage bill. The problem there was the benchmark was just 50-50. But when you look at substantive gender equality, now, when you look at the medical schemes, when they say, look here, replacement of breast is cosmetic surgery, that's taking advantage of women. That's being gender blind. I mean, men don't go for breast implants, so why is the medical aid now punishing women when they suffer from cancer to experience that surgery? What bullshit is that? So the wage bill doesn't deal with issues like that. Then when you take the shop rights and the checkers who put our women on contracts for 3 days and don't give them maternity benefits, no leave pay, nothing, make them work like slaves, wage bill is not dealing with that. So when banks then give loans to to women. They give you, I mean, they apply the same standard as men. But women are not employed and earning the same as men. So why are the banks then discriminating against women? They're excluding them by default. So issues like that, the benchmarking, WGBL didn't address substantive gender equality properly. So that was the major fault we found with it. It was merely coordinating things. And then the enforcement, the minister was relying on reporting to her, just like the Employment Equity Act. Now, the Department of Labor gets reports on labor plans. What difference is it making? Gender transformation not taking place? So the minister is playing games. He doesn't know how to actually bring about gender empowerment. So that was our finding. You must bring about proper, steps if you want to improve the lives of women. And the committee always says that. If we're just going to pander up or work within the framework that men have created, the lives of women is not going to change. And the committee is right. And the minister just didn't see that. She needs to take those companies to task, have proper compliance and penalty clauses. For example, if ShopRite is not conforming to our labor legislation, give them penalties. Don't rely on plans and to evaluate plans. The minister doesn't have the skills to actually identify what's happening in the plans. She doesn't have the capacity. Gender focal points are not going to help. So those are the problems that we found with the WGBL. And it didn't speak to the traditional courts bill and traditional courts. It just said that women must have equal rights in traditional community and customs and practices. So it didn't speak substantively to the issues raised in the traditional courts bill. So there was misalignment there as well. So the only advantage was that the 50-50 and the education programs that must be conducted. Thank you. And the last point is that, look here, we will wait for the regulations, because that's when we can really make substantive changes to the TCB, because the regulations are going to speak to real issues, and we must be really awake, alert, and target the department when it's drafting the regulations. And in the meanwhile, as the ACEO says, we will evaluate these acts and these bills and see the alignment. And we can also do some consultations by the time we reach there. But also when we are consulting with communities, we are looking at a broad set of rights, issues, and matters. Because I don't look at just one focused area when I'm in these consultations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. But could you ensure that nobody closes the door in your faces? You must be clear to monitor whether they're trying to jump certain sensitive areas. Stand up who are behind you in ensuring that the plight of women at all levels is addressed. Patriarchy is killing our feminine fiber. Definitely. And I'll never keep quiet about that. And thanks to the other members of the staff for bringing up some of the questions and the areas of concern. CGE, we're banking on you. And we're prepared to go on oversight together as a team. But this bill must be monitored intensively. Otherwise, we're still making slaves out of women and children. Thank you very much. We can adjourn.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honorable members. Thank you, colleagues. This was one of the most meaningful engagements. It was one of the most meaningful engagements I've had. Thank you.
Behind the laptop, you see that badge there, but it's just in black and white.